Hello everyone, I'm going to start because Katya is going to take the last 15 minutes of today's lecture to talk about next term's units. So today we come to the last set of readings on the question of representation and identity that we have been considering and talking about for the last 3 weeks. And today's critical essays by Stuart Hall and Judith Butler draw upon an idea that I have talked about earlier, but they go into considerable detail. They draw upon the theory that meaning is constructed through language, that language as part of discourse has material effects on our lives, cultures, and politics. This was also the spirit in which Edward Said was talking about Orientalism, that Orientalism as a body of knowledge was not just operative in the sphere of ideas or in the sphere of the imagination, but that it had material, political effects on the history of the world. Okay? So both Hall and Butler also draw upon this idea that discourse has material effects. In fact, Judith Butler goes as far as to suggest that discourse injures bodies. I found that phrase to be quite powerful and interesting, that discourse has the power to injure us, not just as subjects, but also as bodies. And by this, I think she means racist or sexist or homophobic discourse, the power that that has to injure us, both in our subjectivities and in our bodies. Of course, the commonplace example of falsely shouting fire in a cinema hall is another example of this, that how what we say, what we speak, has the power to have effects, material effects. Judith Butler draws on the concept of speech acts as theorized by J.L. Austin, right? And she gives the example from Austin's work where the enunciation of "I pronounce you man and wife," right? The standard enunciation in a marriage ceremony, how it puts into effect the relation that it names, right? So just the enunciation of the sentence, "I pronounce you man and wife," has an effect, right? By naming the relationship, it affects it. It brings it into being. It becomes authoritative speech, right? It is authoritative speech through the invocation of convention, right? That sentence means something to us because there's convention behind it. But more than convention, there's also law behind it, right? Not everyone has the power to make that pronouncement, right? You have to go to a legal or a civic authority for that to happen. So it's the convention and the law that together make that happen. And they also institute, in her argument, heterosexuality as the norm, right? So when a legal authority pronounces two people, man and wife, not only does that have a real material effect, but that also institutes a particular ideal of relationships between men and women as the norm, right? There's a kind of unwritten, normalized heterosexuality that's behind that enunciation. She argues, of course, that enunciation takes place in historically given codes, right? So we all recognize that sentence, we understand its meaning, okay? And thus she concludes that power acts as discourse, right? In the performative speech act. So this is just an example of how speech acts not only exercise power, but they in fact constitute society, right? Constitute its laws, society as we know it. Okay, so I want you to keep this theory in mind. Okay, the idea of speech acts, of power enacting itself through speech acts, through performance, through the act of speaking, through the act of enunciation. Okay, so this is one set of theoretical issues on which Hall and Butler are both basing their discussion. The second critical concept that I want to just briefly talk about, and hopefully in your seminars you'll have a chance to discuss this in detail, is the critical concept of interpellation, right? That both Hall and Butler draw upon. Interpellation, interpellation. Both the essays reference this critical concept. Now, what is meant by interpellation? This is a critical concept in terms of understanding how we become subjects, right? How we become named subjects with particular identities that have to do with race, with gender, with class, with nationality, and so on. Okay? Now, Butler, and she's drawing this theory of interpellation from the Marxist theorist Althusser, Althusser. Okay? It's his theory of interpellation, in which Butler argues that the I, who are we as individuals, as subjects, that only comes into being when we are called by somebody else, right? When we are named by somebody else. This calling into subjectivity, this naming into subjectivity is what is called interpellation. Okay, and I'll just explain this. And following on from this, she says that social recognition precedes and conditions the formation of the subject. So however we define ourselves, right, as man or woman, as white or black or Indian or British, or as homosexual or heterosexual, that this notion, you know, this way of defining ourselves, this naming is what brings forth the identity, right? So again, the significance of language, right, in order to understand things like subjectivity and identity, that identity, we only know of identities because, you know, we have language to understand that. Okay? of course, Butler's interest is in gender, and I believe that you will be reading Butler again in the next unit, which will perhaps be more focused on questions of gender and sexuality, whereas I'm focusing more on Butler's theories of discourse and subjectivity. And Butler gives the example of gender, which she sees as a performance. Okay, so she's taking gender away. She's disconnecting it from biology, right? From sort of the natural associations that we make, you know, in which woman equals femininity, man equals masculinity. She's trying to break that equation, and she sees gender as a performance in which the performance itself constitutes the self, okay? And for her, the example is drag, right? When we see a man in drag, what drag does is that it exposes the naturalization of gender norms, right? Drag forces us to confront, because there's a man dressed as a woman, right? That forces us to confront, what do we expect men to look like? How do we expect men to behave, right? What is our notion of femininity? It denaturalizes, right? It denaturalizes notions of femininity, masculinity, and of gender. The other example she gives, which is again about the power of naming, of interpolation, is when the birth of a female child is accompanied by the statement, it's a girl, right? Now, is that statement just a statement about the biological identity, right, of the newborn baby? Or is the girl, is the word, is the pronouncement of it's a girl about a girling process, right, in which there is a kind of normative association of what girls should be like, right? And of course, in our culture, all around us, we are saturated with images of what girls should look like, what they should wear, what they should be like, their comportment, their gestures, and so on. Okay? So Butler goes on to argue that femininity, from this example, is thus not a product of choice, right? We don't choose to be, as a woman, I haven't chosen to be feminine in a particular way, but it's the forcible citation of a norm, right? So when we are born, we are already interpolated, right? We are already named as girl or boy, and all the associations that come with being a girl or with being a boy, okay? Quite complex and seemingly abstract ideas, but I think interesting ones to think about because they challenge the ways in which we think about gender, right? And the relationship of gender with sex. Often the two are seen as overlapping or similar. They're collapsed, but the aim of Butler's theory is to de-link the two, right? And to think of gender as socially constructed, right, and as constructed through language. Okay. Now, in my seminars at least, I think students have rightly expressed a kind of concern that when we talk about the fact that identity is constructed, right, and that gender is a performance, are we saying that there's no inner core that each one of us has? Are we saying that this is all performance and, you know, there's no core identity? And I think Butler actually addresses that question when she says that identity is about the interplay between what she calls a psychic core that we all have, right? Our sense of being, our sense of who we are. But that sense of being, that sense of who we are, that psychic core is always in play with, it's always interacting with social norms, with social appearances, right, with interpolation. So it's not that one is superior to the other, right? And I guess that's the challenge of Butler's theory and her thinking. She doesn't make the psychic core as superior to social norms or social appearances. They are not just reflections, but that identity lies in between the two, right? It's in the interplay between how we experience ourselves as individuals, as psychic beings, and how we are recognized by others, how we are named by others, the social expectations and norms within which we operate as subjects. Okay? To turn to Stuart Hall and to see how he works this out in his essay on new ethnicities, Stuart Hall takes the example of blackness. Okay, so Butler is interested in gender and in particularly the category of queer, about which I'll say a bit more. But Stuart Hall focuses on blackness. And he comes to somewhat similar conclusions, though in very different critical language and from very different critical training and background and perhaps commitments. But he focuses on blackness and on the shifts in the meaning of blackness, shifts in the conception of blackness and black identity from the 1970s through to the 1980s and 1990s. And this is a shift that I'd also suggested that is recorded by Qureshi in The Buddha of Suburbia, in which what blackness means in the 70s Britain, in which Karim is growing up, and the novel written in 1990, in which Qureshi is looking back at the racial politics of the 1970s, he is in a way registering that blackness or black identity no longer means the same thing, right? And this, in fact, in itself perhaps shows us that identities are historical, right? That identities such as black or white or male or female or heterosexual or homosexual, these are not fixed, transhistorical, transcendent categories, right, that have the same meaning no matter what period you're looking at or where you're thinking of, that these identities shift in their meanings. Okay? In the seminar, I talked about how, for instance, if you look at the history of the United States, you see the shifts as new immigrant communities came into the United States. You know, first the Irish were considered to be black, right? And how they become white as more and more, as other immigrant communities keep coming into the United States, right? So none of these notions are fixed in time, and that is what Hall is interested in. Similarly, Butler examines the term queer, okay? And she is interested in seeing how this term queer, if you look at literature, say, before the 1960s, the word queer is typically used to signal degradation, right? Abjection. In fact, it's used, you know, in a quite common way as a word to denote a kind of shaming, right? To use the word queer is a kind of shaming. And she's interested in how the gay and lesbian movement takes up this term, which has been a term of shame and abuse, and how it turned it around to give it a new meaning, in fact, a very positive meaning, right? And so the word queer was appropriated by the gay and lesbian movement to reflect a kind of questioning of the norm, a kind of positive identity, right? So to take something which is abjected and to make it positive. And of course, for Butler, and this we can see also in terms of blackness, right? The black power movement of the 60s and 70s, the slogan of black is beautiful, right? Where the idea of blackness, which was seen as something to be ashamed of, which was abjected, becomes something that is to be celebrated, okay? For Butler, the question is that, is this a simple reversal, right? Do we just reverse the terms of engagement? And can this reversal overcome its history of injury, right? Can we just take words and terms that have been degraded words and terms and turn them around, right? And give them positive meaning. Butler insists that there's a limit to this kind of a political project, right? That there's a limit to the politics of self-naming. And in a way, her essay is a critique of identity politics, right? Which she argues has its own exclusionary apparatuses, has its own exclusionary processes. And this you see in the Buddha of Suburbia as well. I think she asks the question, who can afford to come out, right? And how does an out homosexual identity, how does it interplay with religious identities, with cultural, ethnic, class, and other identities, right? So the ways in which the word queer, she's suggesting, has become part of a first world, mainstream, mostly white movement, right? And how the word needs to be constantly examined because it may be excluding gays and lesbians from the third world, right? Could they identify as queer? Can they come out in the same ways as the movement has had people come out in Britain and in North America? So what she is suggesting is a persistent critique of the terms that we use, right? And a persistent critique of identity and the language that we use to describe identity. Okay? She suggests that, of course, sometimes we do need to be reductive. What she calls an error, a necessary error of identity, because otherwise no politics can be possible, right? We can keep saying we are all so different. There's no way we can come together on anything, right? But she says that, of course, people do need to come together under identity labels, right? Whether as students, as working class people, as women, and so on, right? For political engagement, right? But to be always conscious that when we use the word working class, Does it mean the same things, right? If you are a white person, you know, living in Coventry versus if you are a recent Indian immigrant, does the term working class, can it unite everybody? Yes, it may for a certain time being, but also to be aware of its limitations. Okay. To turn to Stuart Hall again and to return to this idea of blackness that Hall examines in his essay, in which he talks about the fact that in the 1970s, blackness was a common umbrella term that was used by all people from minority communities in Britain, right? So whether they were Asian or Caribbean or African, everybody came together under the umbrella of a black identity, right? And of course, you know, with the coming in of Margaret Thatcher, the intensification of racism, this kind of umbrella identity was very necessary, right, to question the hegemonic racism of the British state and of the establishment. In the first lecture on Buddha of Suburbia, I'd given you a quote from Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, right, which in a way pushed people into identifying under the larger term of black, in which black was the invisible other of dominant white aesthetic and political discourses. So black becomes an organizing category of a politics of resistance among groups that in fact had very different histories, traditions, and ethnic backgrounds. So it was, in a way, as Butler uses the word, a necessary fiction, right? A necessary error to challenge racism, okay? And Hall says that at this moment in the 70s, this activism, black activism, was focused on the question of changing the relations of representation. So the activism was focused on giving black actors, as it plays out in Buddha of Suburbia, black artists, access to the stage, access to the public media, to the public sphere, and a kind of contestation of the stereotype. Right, a move towards a more accurate portrayal. And you see that playing out in the novel. From the late 1980s onwards, Hall locates a shift in the meaning and politics of blackness. Okay? He locates the emergence of a new politics that is about engaging difference. So there's a shift from a kind of an umbrella, a somewhat homogenizing identity of blackness, right, to a politics of difference, okay? So that, of course, the term black is a necessary error. It's problematic because not everybody is black in the same way and that there are major differences among all the people who identify themselves as black, okay? I'll just show you a brief clip where Hall is presenting this idea in a quite provocative way. Okay. Provocative assertion there by Stuart Hall that, yes, of course, there is the brute reality of race, of racism, of racial violence. But I think he sticks to his fundamental point that we come to an understanding of that racist violence and of that brute material reality through language, through discourse. After all, those same images, right, the lynchings, the hanging tree, meant very different things in the 19th century, right, than they do now for us. For Hall, then, difference, the politics of difference, then, is not about a radical separation from each other, but an awareness of positions, an awareness of historical conditions and of conjunctures. Okay? And it is this shift that he characterizes as a politics of representation, in which reality is not necessarily somewhere outside the representation, right? But reality is between the brute physicality of racism and its representation. And here again, I think we can see a common ground with Judith Butler, who does not deny a psychic core, right, but sees identity in the interplay of the psychic core and social appearance. And I think Hall is taking a similar position in which the meaning of racism, he insists, is constructed through language. And this, for him, marks the end of the notion of an essential black subject. And what are the political consequences, then, of this? In which, as he argues, blackness is no longer a guarantee of practice or value, okay? Because I guess the argument is that once, in response to this brute reality, if we go over to the other side, to a completely uncritical side, in which there is no critique of a term such as blackness or black identity, what we are giving up on is what he privileges and what Judith Butler privileges, which is a politics of criticism, a politics of persistent critique, right? To not be presumptuous or not be self-satisfied, right? That we have figured out everything and now there is nothing new to be figured out. What both Butler and Hall are asking us to do is to constantly examine, even as we need to use terms of identity, to constantly examine them, how they operate. Okay. Now, of course, there have been criticisms of Stuart Hall's position. People who have argued that one can see in recent times a decline of politics, a decline of political engagement, a decline of politics around class, right? The heyday of union struggles, of working class movements, of anti-racism movements, of the feminist movement. We are all witnessing a decline of all of those movements which had been based on a very strong sense of identity. In fact, many people would argue that even as, you know, contemporary capitalism seems to be hurtling from one crisis to another, socially there's been very little sense of an alternative to that, or indeed opposition to that, right? If you look at figures of growing unemployment in the United States and Britain, it hasn't been met by people coming out in the streets and challenging the situation that this has brought them, that has brought this kind of misery, immiseration, and unemployment for them. For I think both Hall and Butler, these are not necessarily opposed or the only choices available, that you have an essentialist notion of identity and therefore you can have politics, or that you have a politics of difference and therefore a larger sense of politics is impossible. I think both insist on how a common struggle can be based on difference, but on difference that is contingent, that is contextual, but that is nevertheless committed to a sense of solidarity, so that different groups can come together to fight on particular issues, to express solidarity with each other for a political purpose. I think nevertheless this continues to be quite a difficult and a contested idea, right? What do we do when we have these kinds of critiques of identity and of identity politics? How do we forge a politics out of the end of identity as we knew it? If we are to say that there are no essential identities, how are we going to forge a new political engagement, new kinds of political activism? I think that these questions are still open and open to debate, but I do think that both Butler and Hall open up new arenas for thinking, and I think for modes of reading, the main thing I take from both Butler and Hall is this idea of criticism as a privileged political act, right? The fact that, you know, we are learning ways of looking at texts, at social realities, at discourses and languages from a critical perspective. And critical not just in terms of, you know, denunciation, critical in the sense of looking at the contradictions of discourse, of language, of theories, of theorists and their positions, that is the point in some ways that Butler and Hall are making. Okay? So I'm going to stop there and have Katia take over.